I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. It's not an uncommon thing to hear in the borderland or anywhere across Texas, the blending of inglés con español when Latinos están hablando con each other. I'm guilty of it. We call it Spanglish. Academics call it U.S. Spanish or Heritage Spanish. It results when Latinos living in the U.S. grow up where both English and Spanish are commonly spoken. While it may be frowned upon and ridiculed by individuals who speak a more formal, correct form of Spanish, or even by their relatives, academics are recognizing Heritage Spanish as a valid, useful form of the language that offers speakers a unique cultural foundation that should be cultivated. Megan Peace is an associate professor of Spanish at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. As a social linguist, she studies heritage Spanish speakers' attitudes over their language. Emily Bernante, an associate professor of Spanish at St. Edward's University in Austin, is also a social linguist who studies how the verbs heritage Spanish speakers use change over generations and how they differ by gender.
When I was a graduate student at University of Houston, I would also teach classes for Spanish for heritage learners. And in those classes, I always noticed that the girls would ask me for things in different ways than the boys would ask me for things. And it was semester after semester.
Well, what are some examples?
Sure, I'll give you an example. So if a student wanted to turn in something a little bit later in the day, my girl students would often say things like, "Profesora, ¿le molesta si o será posible que me entregue que más tarde, que tenga más tiempo? Pero si si no es molestia," and I would get lots of qualifiers on "if you don't mind" and "if that's okay," and really very little present tense, lots of conditional tense, podría, even pudieras, which is an imperfect subjunctive. And those tenses, what they do is they remove the verb form very far from the present reality. They're not simple present tenses. When I would get the same kinds of requests from men, it was very puedo, just can I, or se puede, can it be, you know, right? Not a lot of removing the request temporally and materially using these abstract verb conjugation. So I thought, this can't be an accident. It's every semester the girls are asking for something in one way and the boys are asking for it in a different way.
Are the girls just nicer?
Right.
More polite?
Exactly. I had to deal with those kinds of questions in politeness research. Is it really just that women are more polite? And no, it's not that women are just more polite. I think on one hand, what's considered more polite for a woman and for a man are quite different. I do think that's part of it. But the other part was that the women in their families tended to hang on to Spanish a bit longer. It seems that it was women placed a higher value on maintaining the language of their parents because they were the ones that reported that when they had children, they were the ones that prioritized being able to have enough Spanish that they could carry on conversations with their children in Spanish so that their children could carry on conversations with the grandparents. That was lower priority for the men.
Megan, your focus is mostly on how people view their use of Spanish. Like, for example, myself, the first language that I learned was Spanish. But once I got into school, once you start thinking in English, that's when it all takes over. So I know that my Spanish is very imperfect, as my mother is frequently trying to remind and correct me. But the times when I use English in my conversations in Spanish is usually because I can't think of the right word to say, mm-hmm. or the right tense, the right usage of the mm-hmm. word. And I don't want to say it's shameful, but it's a little embarrassing for somebody who, you know, who grew up on the border, who should know better. And I'm sure that, Megan, you have come across very similar feelings amongst your students.
That's entirely true. Yes. My students, many of them are exactly in the same position as you. They started speaking Spanish. They received a lot of English input when they went to school. And then they see their Spanish. They describe it as Spanglish. They describe it as Tex-Mex. They tend to see it as not formal, not professional and not correct. But they really do see it as something shameful indeed. And what you say about your parents correcting you, this is something that they receive as well from their parents. And I find language mixing to be completely fascinating. I find it to be not just fascinating linguistically, but also culturally, as it is used to really express a particular cultural identity. And I see them being ashamed of it. And I think, oh, this is this wonderful resource that you have. This is a fascinating thing that you're doing.
And so, Emily, I remember taking a Spanish class in college and feeling like an absolute complete foreigner. It was a Spanish for native speakers class that I took because I thought, well, I know Spanish. I think I can be all right in this course. And turns out that it was all the grammatical intricacies that really threw me off, that real native Spanish speakers really don't have a problem with. And I'm sure this is something that learners of other languages have problems with, just the correct usage of certain words. And I'm sure it abounds more in the borderlands region, where we really don't know too much of the actual correct usage that native Mexicans might use closer to the interior that we would use here in Texas, closer to the border. What are your observations about that?
Several things. First, I want to, if I go to my best friend right now in English and I say, well, hello, how are you doing today? It's fancy seeing you here. That person is going to think, are we not friends anymore? What's going on, right? So we have different registers, and sometimes we think that a formal register is more correct, when really all it is just appropriate for formal situations. So the informal registers that our Spanish speakers come with in a heritage class, they're actually very correct. They're very correct for making friends and going to the tiendita to pick up a bottle of milk. They're really correct for telling their mom about their day and for planning a birthday party for their cousin. They're really correct in that situation, and using a different, more formal register probably wouldn't be so correct in those situations. So we do a lot of work in class, in the heritage class, of reframing what we think about correctness and work more with the idea of appropriateness. So we work on validating those skills that they already have and then saying, okay, so where do these skills not work as well for us? Writing something in a business meeting, or conducting an interview in Spanish, or filling out paperwork. We might need some different words for that. So it's not that we don't have the correct words, we just don't have that register. So we work on polishing that. Just the way we couldn't put a second language learner in a heritage class, they would die because they wouldn't know what we're saying. Heritage learners also don't work well in classes that are designed for native speakers until they've been given more tools, because they just haven't had those experiences. You know, we're all products of our experiences. That sounds rather existentialist, but we really are just the sum of the language experiences that people have given to us.
Now, Megan, do you know that if this type of back and forth type of code switching between languages occurs in other cultures, or is it predominantly here on the border between English and Spanish?
I would say that it occurs anytime you have a situation where there are languages in contact. If you have a population that is bilingual and both of those languages are regularly used, you're going to have these phenomena of contact. You're going to have the code switching. You're going to have lexical borrowings from one language to the other. You have word-for-word translations of one phrase in one language to the other language. So these are phenomena that you see whenever there is a situation of language contact. And that's why we see it so much here on the border, because we do have a population that does speak English and Spanish quite competently and is continuously mixing from one language to the other. So, yes, it's a very natural result of language contact.
So I'm assuming, Emily, Megan, when you two were learning Spanish, you probably learned the more formal style. How difficult was it for you to sort of backtrack and say, oh, they don't mean park, like estacionar there, saying parquear. I'm going to park the car. I'm going to get in my troca. I'm not going to get in my camioneta, you know, going to get in the truck. It just tends to, we find a lot of shortcuts around here to find the right word, but yet still everybody gets it.
Well, I mean, I am your typical second language speaker of Spanish, and my major exposure to Spanish has been in the classroom. So yes, I know all of the grammar. I know what all of the verbs are called. I'm very familiar with all of that. And my students, actually much to my annoyance, will tell me, you speak Spanish better than I do. And I think, no, of course I do not. There's no way that I speak Spanish better than you do. But they're, of course, reacting to the fact that my register tends to be quite a bit more formal. My language use has principally been in academia. So I can use Spanish to talk about research. I can use Spanish to talk about teaching. I can use Spanish to talk about the workings of the university. However, I struggle more to use Spanish to talk about cooking or home repair, things like that, simply because I have never used Spanish in that particular context. And when you're talking about the trocas and the parquear and the lonche, yeah, it's something that I'm picking up slowly. And I spent however many years it was saying almuerzo, and then every now and then a lonche will pop out. But still, I have so many more years of using, if you will, the textbook Spanish. And it is still very much a process for me.
My first experiences with Spanish are from the border and then abroad. So I guess I'm kind of a Spanish mutt. I have, I'm interesting for the students when I come up with words that are from different varieties that have stuck with me that I just particularly like, and they don't always mix.
So
my favorite word for having messy hair is despelucado. It's a Colombian word, but peluca is a wig.
It's a wig.
So if you're despelucado, maybe you are de-wigged.
I'm not sure.
But your wig is a mess. But it's one of those words that I'm not going to give up because I just love how it sounds.
Spanish mutt, I like that. I'd say me as well. Yeah. There are certain words that I have just liked and certain words that have just stuck with me.
Well, give us an example.
Pendientes for earrings. Oh. Yes. My first experience abroad was when I was an undergrad and I went to study abroad in Spain, and I really, really like earrings, and they have many wonderful earrings that you can purchase there for very cheap. So, of course, I'm going there using aretes, which is what I had learned in the textbook, but that's not what they say there. They say pendientes, and because, well, earrings are very important to me, I just started saying pendientes, and that was, God, that was 16 years ago now, and it has stuck.
We've been speaking with social linguist Megan Peace, associate professor of Spanish at St. Mary's University in San Antonio, and with Emily Bernante, associate professor of Spanish at St. Edward's University in Austin, another social linguist who studies heritage Spanish, or U.S. Spanish, more commonly known to us as Spanglish. When we come back, after years of talking about renovations, the San Antonio Mexican movie palace, the Alameda Theater, may soon see a future that preserves its past.
I hope that they will be doing the right thing, not to distort, you know, the recognition of the building, because they're going to be destroying, you know, the sentimental feelings, the theater in its early days.
That's next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. One of the last classic Mexican movie palaces in San Antonio still stands, but in disrepair. It was built in 1949 and for three decades hosted not only films, but variety shows known as variedades and appearances by stars of Mexico's golden age, Pedro Infante, María Félix, and Cantinflas. And unlike other nearby theaters, it offered desegregated seating. The Alameda Theater was and remains a landmark of Hispanic culture in San Antonio. The Alameda closed in the late 1980s. There have been numerous attempts to revive it, but the latest might be the one that sticks. The city of San Antonio, in partnership with Bexar County, La Familia Cortez, a family business that owns five restaurants in town, and Texas Public Radio, plan to restore and revive the Alameda as a multimedia live performing arts and film center serving the Latino community. Texas Public Radio's future headquarters will be housed adjacent to the theater and the non-historic backstage structure. But before we get into the plans for renovation, it's important to remember the cultural relevance the Alameda has in the community. A recent open house hosted by the Alameda Theater Conservancy featured a tour of its theater and its grounds. When you get to the front doors of the Alameda, you're greeted by giant illustrated panels of a charro and a woman in traditional Mexican dress with flowers in her hair. On either side are elaborate curved stairways that lead theatergoers to the balcony. The stairways, bordered by elaborately sketched plexiglass railings, are blocked off for safety. The theater is nearly in the shape it was when it ceased to operate 2 decades ago. Chicano scholar and art historian Tomás Ibarra Frausto led the tour and says the history of the Alameda is reflective of the history of San Antonio. Ibarra Frausto says when the Alameda was in its prime, this was where the Mexican-American community learned about itself.
And the movies told about the revolution, the revolutionary heroes, Zapata, Pancho Villa, and it also showed the indigenous communities in Mexico. Remember, a lot of this was not taught to us in high school or in elementary school. And so we saw and learned the history through the movies.
When you pass through the lobby and under the Art Deco chandeliers and walk through the double doors on either side, you see a wide expanse of emptiness. This is where thousands of bodies would have sat in the dark, passing popcorn down the aisle with eyes glued to the stage or the screen. There are no seats there now. And if you walk closer to the stage area, there are just a few chairs and a projector showing some short films on a screen. But when you turn around to look back at the house, the first thing that grabs your attention is a huge balcony, which is shrouded in darkness. And when you look to your left and your right, you see large blue-tinted murals. Ibarra Frausto explains their meaning.
On the left-hand side is the story of Texas. You can see, you know, the Spaniards coming with their oxen. And then the buildings, you see the cathedral, you see the Alamo. And it's sort of like the history of Texas. And then on this side was the history of Mexico. And you see the Spaniards, Columbus coming, and then you see the conquistadores.
And what makes the murals even more special, they're drawn with phosphorescent black light paint. They're meant to glow in the dark. Ibarra Frausto says the murals and the building itself is a symbolic union of the two cultures that make up Texas and San Antonio. Rachel Delgado, a member of the Westside Preservation Alliance, has fond childhood memories of seeing shows at the Alameda.
Enjoying the Mexican movies, the variedades, running around the theater, and the ladies' lounge was glamorous. Mirrors all along the wall. The little table was a bean shape, you know, curved around. I was a little girl, and I felt so glamorous in there.
And 97-year-old Jesus Rios Vidales, a short, spry, spirited man, remembers entertaining theatergoers outside the Alameda with his Mexican trio, El Trio Los Románticos, and having the gumption to ask the manager for permission to play inside.
I told him, "My name is Jesse Vidales. I used to be a singer back in my days, and I still sing every now and then. I got my trio, and I wanted to see if you could give me permission to come in and sing one or three songs." "Oh, yes, yes, come on in, come on in." And I loved it.
Plans to revive the Alameda Theater include converting the 3,000-seat venue into a more intimate 1,000-seat space. It'll include modern sound and lighting upgrades and the restoration of historically significant structures like the stairways, the glamorous mirrored women's powder rooms, and the expansive balcony. 97-year-old Jesse Vidalis has hopes the spirit of the building will not be tarnished with shiny new upgrades.
I hope that they will be doing the right thing, not to distort, you know, the recognition of the building, because they're going to be destroying, you know, the sentimental feelings, the theater in the early days. And I know we will continue to see La Alameda.
Construction is set to begin in July 2019, with completion in fall 2020. Norma Martinez, Texas Public Radio News.
Pasaste a mi lado.
Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
Se ahogó dentro de mí, me duele hasta la vida saber que me olvidaste, pensar que ni desprecios merezca yo de ti, y sin embargo sigues.